Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I will be your host today. And I'm speaking with Dr. Sofia Gavrilova, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the Leibniz Institute for Regional Geography in Leipzig and a human geographer of post-Soviet spaces, about her monograph, Russia's Regional Museums, Representing and Misrepresenting Knowledge About Nature, History, and Society. Dr. Gavrilova, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for inviting. It's my pleasure.
So to start us off, can you talk just a bit about your research background and kind of how you became interested in this topic?
Yes, for sure. Actually, I have my background in physical geography. So I got my first PhD degree, which is called or referred to quite often as Kandidatskaya degree of science, from Moscow State University when I was studying snow avalanches in mountains. I was fascinated by natural disasters. So I've done my first PhD in natural disasters, actually. But then I kind of lack the possibility to go deeply in theory and in like critical studies that I wanted to. And when I first started drafting my application, my PhD application, because the book is based on my PhD project at University of Oxford, of course, it was very wide and unstructured and very bad application. And I was just curious how the places are represented and what are the images that are constructed in different media, including propaganda media, which started to appear, launched by Russian Geographical Society. And then I started to look more closely on what is feasible in 3 years. And I just, you know, came across a small museum near my dacha, near my country house in Moscow region. And the Kravyedenye Museum, and I was just fascinated again. I kind of recall this emotions of how they look alike, how these museums look alike in different places. And and that's aligned with my initial research proposal and the necessity to narrow it down. And that is how I kind of decided to dedicate the whole research to the network. Mm-hmm. Of the museums.
It's such an innovative project. I just really, really enjoyed this because I think I mentioned when I first asked you to do this interview that I'm also looking at some similar questions around sacred space in Russia. And there's just so little that's been done so far. So I was very excited to find your book.
Thank you very much. Yes, this is also something which surprised me a lot when I started doing the research, that Kravyedenye network in generally and the museums in particular somehow were massively overlooked in recent years in academia. So there are like studies of Kravyedenye done within Kravyedenye scholarship in Russia, you know, like history of Kravyedenye and things like this. But there are really not that much critical approaches. And which is still lacking, which I kind of failed to do, is try to place a Krajovedenie museum as a distant type of socialist museum in kind of embedded into the museum scholarship. Mm-hmm. That is also something that is, I think, has to be done.
And what was your research and particularly your field work experience like?
I enjoyed it very much. I think it's, I spent almost every summer during these 3-4 years and even a couple of winters in the different parts of Russia. And because I decided to kind of pursue this diachronical approach, so I, the present state of the museums was equally important as their archival work. I have chosen the places which I was interested in. And that's just, I'm still very grateful that I had an opportunity to go to all these places and to meet all these people and to talk to them. So it was amazing. it was just really breathtaking experience visiting both the museums, the local and regional archives, and being able to actually drive to the places that that I was eager to see.
Mm-hmm. So the Krajovedenie Museum, you talk in your introduction about how it's kind of ubiquitous, right? There's almost, it exists in every town or city. So what is their main purpose?
I think it depends on the time period that we're talking about. So I would say that if we try to generalize, their main purpose is to reflect or to create a certain amount of patterns a citizen can feel connected with or react to. And what difference through the history of Krajovedenie is who was creating these patterns and how they were selected, how the objects were selected to reflect those. But the main purpose is just to show the typical, which place them kind of on completely different spectrum from, for example, ethnographical museum who were and are to a certain extent showing untypical, right? The curiosities, right? Grew up from the cabinets of curiosities in Europe. And Krajovedenie Museum is showing typical. So I would say that for a visitor, for a tourist, they fulfill the function of just showing what the place consists of. And for locals, I think the main purpose is to create this construction of a place identity. They can or they should they should connect to. That's what I would put it.
And just to define for listeners who don't know the language, what is the meaning of Krajovedenie?
So Krajovedenie, it means literally learning your local lore or looking your motherland. And in scholarly tradition, in Western academic tradition, it's usually reduced to the local history, which I'm kind of trying to confront in my book, because I think that apart from historical narrative, the representation of nature and society and studying the nature and the society are equally important, are also important in the concept. So just saying that it's local history, I think it's a simplification of the concept. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what it stands for.
Mm-hmm. So in the introduction, you write, I'm going to just quote, Krajovedenie museums are not just an important and gravely understudied aspect of the region's cultural landscape, but a very powerful example of the decolonization of the predominant Western paradigm of knowledge production. So I just thought this was so interesting. Could you talk a little bit about how your study broadens this paradigm of the geographies of scientific knowledge?
Oh, wow. I really wrote it. Oh, that's good.
Yes, that's your word.
No, I think what I was trying to say that as we talked before that, краеведение is a specific form of knowledge production, which is kind of unique, right? And which is represented in a material form in краеведение museums. But apart from my museums, you know, there are tons and tons of literature and texts written by scholars and volunteers in 20th century through this lens of краеведение, right? And for example, if you start looking into like lit review what was written, there are books on how краеведение should be taught in schools. They were aspirantura, like the PhD degrees in краеведение in universities. So it was really, I think, a lot of efforts were put into kind of justification of this discipline slash research method, because this is also what was unclear for the Soviet scholars. What are they actually trying to embed in academia, in Soviet mm-hmm. academia? Is it a research method, or is it discipline, or is it just something which goes parallel with the official science as, you know, sorry, I missed the word, as... what is it? As a citizen science, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I even tried to make this parallel in my book, saying that actually, if we look in the research design of краеведение, it looks really, really similar to many civil science research projects that we're witnessing now, but pre-internet, right? Mm-hmm. In the times where there was no possibility to use the internet. So, like, I think it's important to embed these initiatives, and I'm quite sure that there are a lot of them when, you know, it's not a unique thing in terms of just different way of producing knowledge, geographical knowledge, ethnographical knowledge, historical narratives from... the predominant ways it was done, let's say in mid-century West, whatever West we stand, whatever we call West, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. Europe and US. So that's what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying that I think that it's interesting to see краеведение as an alternative form of knowledge production, which, you know, was set up and run for almost, I would say, 50 years as a state-sponsored project of knowledge production.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there's like more than 800 of these museums in Russia, right? So how did you decide which ones you were going to include in your case studies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So my starting point was the hypothesis that, or just curiosity, why the museum looks so alike, right? So I was driven by that question. And so I just started to think where I can find different narratives and different representations. And so that is how my attempt chose, you know, the most distant places as Chukotka, or the distance or the regions with very mixed ethnographical background, like Yakutia, for example, or the or Tatarstan, which is a Muslim region. So mm-hmm. this is like was the logic behind of that. I just was trying to choose places which I would expect them to challenge the краеведение representation, or to produce where I would expect to find something different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long did your field work take?
I would say that I've done it in a wrong way also. I spent the first summer in the archives. And then I just traveled every summer back. So let me count. So I think it was three field seasons in total. I would say about half a year if we count them all the months together. But I was trying to spend time in Oxford as well because I was eager to kind of participate in the Oxford life. So I would say that I was dedicating summers to the field work. And it was basically every summer for 3 years, 3.5 years.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty typical, right? Kind of trajectory. So you mentioned before that this concept of this museum is obviously it's part of Soviet ethnography, geography, history. So what are some of the key Soviet academic theories that shape how these museums were kind of created and promulgated?
Well, I would say that speaking about like theory behind, well, not behind, but like in this book, I would say that it's equally important to talk about what shaped the presence and also an absence of certain narratives and places and peoples in the museum. So I think that it's. The link between the predominant theories, the in geography, the predominance of Marxist-Leninist approach towards geography and the importance of, well, we can't call it strictly environmental determinism, but like the influence of environmental determinism, which says that the way people look and behave is explained by the climatic conditions and environment where they live. That's all shaped the expositions. I would say that if we talk about ethnography and history, of course, in all the museums, the history is the history of the Russian state. In a place, right? So even when you go to Chukotka, even if you go to very distant villages where nobody goes to, you will still see that the local museums will kind of show the history of the Soviet presence in Chukotka and Soviet colonization of Chukotka, not the indigenous histories. So I think like this is how historical approaches and Soviet policies in nation building and mastering the backwards, and I put it in brackets in the quote, I'm quoting the documents, educating the backwards nation, right? That's how it's called. So that's where we see origins of the expositions that we see. But also it's equally interesting to see, for example, then that even in the larger cities, the museums do not show the cities itself. So the city kind of is never present. And that is because, you know, the urban studies and social economical geographies were not that popular in Soviet times. So they have completely different approaches to study the influence of a human on landscapes and on building cities and things like that. So I think when I was trying to say that this the museums reflect the predominant theories, I was referring to this mostly, I would say. Mm-hmm. I hope it's clear.
Yeah, and that's really that surprises me actually that the city itself was not even included in the museums. That's really fascinating. So actually on that same topic, so a key element of your analysis, which you already mentioned, is this idea of what you call the common unsaid, which you described as the negative form of a cultural myth. So I'm going to quote again. You write that the common unsaid represents a historical event or landscape that is set aside and omitted from public discourse, despite its influence on a society or local environment. And you argue that the Krajevedenje museums played a key role in the development of these Soviet common unsaids. So could you talk a little bit more about this?
Sure. I find it really, really actually important to talk about this. And I only, you know, scratched the surface with my book because I think that what is omitted and what is not shown and what is not talked about is, as we all know from, you know, memory studies and and like critical histories, is the most intriguing. But I think it's really important to see that concept and or to stretch this concept beyond just historical narrative. So it's really easy to, you know, to say that we know that there have been thousands of gulag camps and they're not shown. Okay, this is the common unsaid. That is like the absence that museum is producing and reproducing. But apart from that, there are equally the places which are not shown, you know. And I find it also important not to stick to not showing, but actually seeing that, as I wrote in my book, as the different methods, different discursive techniques of how these unsaids could be created, right? And here I kind of build upon Bart and Svetlana Boym. So I take from Bart's myth-making discursive techniques, and I kind of, you know, then build on poems, how they were constructed or, you know, reproduced it in silences. And I'm just trying to say that, you know, when you go on the website of Gulag museums in Russia, and you see these numbers of museums which mention the presence of the Gulag. Well, I think it's not enough just to be happy that so many regional museums are talking about Gulag, because the way they do, you know, it's also important. And if you don't, for example, embed the state of the place's economy, if you don't embed the history of the Gulag in that, right? Or if you just put one A4 paper about the Gulag in the corner, that is, yeah, in Perm or in Yakutsk, that is not enough. So we can say, yeah, okay, we acknowledge the presence of the Gulag, but, you know, it's that's not true. Actually, right? This is just, So I think there are all these discursive techniques which create this false or not, well, we can't say false because we don't have a truth, but which create quite a twisted narrative. And this narrative can include the total exclusion, but also all other forms of myth making, like acknowledging, like inoculation, acknowledging the part of an evil, not to acknowledge the evil to a certain, to a bigger extent, right? Mm-hmm. The classic Bart's example, which are important to be named and, you know, kind of revealed. So yeah, that's what I meant by it.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to circle back for a minute to something you said earlier, that even if you're, you know, in Chukotka or some very remote region, there will still be a museum. And I'm just wondering if there's any difference in sort of a museum that seems to be geared for the local population to learn about their own region versus in a bigger place that might be for tourists, or were they kind of curated in the same ways?
Can you repeat it again? I'm not sure that I got what you're asking.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I'm thinking, so if you have a museum in a remote city where there's not a lot of tourists, right? Is there any difference between a museum, a Karavidinye museum in that kind of city, as opposed to a more populous city that will have tourists in addition to the local population looking at it?
Well, yes. You know, that's the most fascinating part. Actually, no. And there is, I couldn't, I was trying to find a pattern of creating or contesting the narrative, the Soviet narrative. I was trying to find this pattern and I couldn't. So basically the history is that the centralized governance of Краеведение Museum started to decline in 1950s. And right now, well, at least until the last year, and that's something we can discuss later, there was no centralized governance of the network. So there was the gap for the freedom and the gap, the space and time where Краеведение Museum could have actually, redo the expositions. And many of them did. For example, again, the museum in Tomsk, the fascinating museum in Tomsk, who won a lot of their exposition, won a lot of grants in Moscow, but also internationally, who started to challenge the Soviet heritage in their museums, who started to implement new approaches and new narratives and engage with public. And they've done the whole project about the relocation identity, because a lot of people in the region were just children and grandchildren of those who were sent to Tomsk by the Soviet authorities, deported. And they've done it. And this is Tomsk. It's quite a big city. While in my small villages in Chukotka, the beautiful ladies who run the museum would tell completely different story to me if we're in a museum and if we're drinking tea, and mm-hmm. they're just telling me their story of their families. That would be completely different narratives, and they would not make an effort. No, I don't want to say that sounds wrong. They would not kind of understand that they have the power maybe to influence the exposition in the museum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, right?
Answering to your question, no, I could not find where this freedom to redo the exhibitions, what it depended on, what it depends mm-hmm. on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really interesting that there's kind of two narratives coexisting, right, in the same space, and in the space in which you are kind of determines how you present it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the most fascinating aspects of this study was how the museums construct and present nature and the relationship between humans and nature. So could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. The book is structured in like analyzing this golden triad of Краеведение, so which it's also, it's only appeared in 1930s, because before that there was a certain freedom in the way Краеведение museums were, the ones which existed before 1930s, of course, how they represented their place, and it was not a golden rule that they would divide their space onto these three areas. So it's only appeared in 1930s. And what fascinated me with these instructions on the representation, that they were so detailed. So that's where this Sovietness, where this the same kind of representation and narrative comes from, right? Which we see in all the museums. So they were very detailed. And the Soviet ideas of human nature relationships were very specific, right? They, from one hand, they were talking about the importance of a socialist man and their and its mm-hmm. Power over the nature and power to change the nature, and that where all this beautiful project of turning rivers, and forestation and deforestations come from. So from one hand, almost all the museums would have this. But from the other hand, as a kind of to manage the consequences of that, they would have this concept of free, virgin nature, which is untouched by a human being, you know, and that leads us, for example, to the appearance of zapovedniki, or very specific type of land conservation initiatives in Soviet times, where there were hundreds of just places which were banned from any human presence, right? So I think that is what you can quite easily find in every museum. This kind of coexistence from one hand on the importance of the mineral deposits of, you know, of oil, of any kind of mineral you can find in a land, how it can be or was used by places, economy, and what was done with it. And then on the other hand, it would have this beautiful, sometimes even painted with drawings and pieces of background walls painted with this very, very pristine paysages. As there were no one present. So I would say this is quite predominant. And also, of course, there's going to be a lot of stuffed animals, like the bear and who else would be there? Moose, right? Mm-hmm. What else? I think that's the main part. So, and it's interesting because it's literally in the museums in Perm, in Yakutsk, and in Anadyr, you would see the part of the exhibition with fur, for example, about the fur production, you know, and this is, would be the part of the representation of the nature. So things like this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so like embedding it in the local economy simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know our listeners will be wondering sort of what has the role of these museums been in the Putin era, and to what extent do they kind of get involved in sort of Putin ideology, Putin era knowledge production?
Yeah, and this is very interesting topic, because when I was doing my research, and it was in 2014, 15, 16. The whole network seemed to be kind of abandoned by governmental discourse. So of course, you know, you could have seen like the presence of the portrait of Putin or Medvedev, but there were no no strong state sponsored propaganda. There would be more like Soviet heritage than like new developments. And what was even more surprising, that in parallel to that, in the big cities, in the city with a population more than 1 million people, they started to build these new museums, which called Russia My Historia, Russia My History. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like this huge museum parks, you know, they like expo parks, where they would put state-sponsored narrative. So for a certain time, these two networks even coexisted, and Krajevedenie network was actually, well, it looked like it was abandoned, and it started to open up to the new Krajevedenie initiative, for example, which tried to bring Krajevedenie back to more to indigenous local production and family histories and local histories. But what happened last December, before the start of the war, is that the Ministry of Culture presented the new concept of Krajevedenie Museum and the new standard of Krajevedenie Museum. It was in the conference in St. Petersburg. And then like the community started to fear that maybe this is going to be the new future of the network, so that they were going to be developed the new standards, and they will be just implemented from above, as it was done in 1930s or in 1950s, and right now it's really hard to say, as you can imagine, what's happening in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so of course we're in time in flux, and Россия моя история certainly has its own very, very kind of noticeable, readable ideology embedded into it. So to wrap up our conversation, could you talk a little bit about your current project, and is this something you're still working on?
Sure. Now I am not working on this project anymore, at least for now, though I would really love to engage more with the history, intellectual history of краеведение, and definitely would be interesting to look in more details in the way краеведение network in other former Soviet countries exists now, mm-hmm. if at all. Right now, I'm working on the question on the geographical education in present Russia and in late Soviet times. And my other project is dedicated to the Russian immigration, after war immigration. And I'm trying to look at the receiving communities in Georgia and Armenia and how how, if at all, we can frame and define what is perceived to be imperial behavior from the newly arrived Russians. So I'm looking at the tensions and narratives that are happening around the new wave of Russian immigration to these countries.
That is really interesting. I will look forward to that research as well. Thank you for listening to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies on the New Books Network. I have been speaking with Dr. Sofia Gavrilova, author of Russia's Regional Museums, Representing and Misrepresenting Knowledge About Nature, History, and Society, now available from Routledge. Dr. Gavrilova, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.